History shows that people have always used intoxicants. In every age, in every part of the world, people have pursued intoxication with plants, alcohol, and other mind-altering substances. In fact, this behavior has so much force and persistence that it functions much like our drives for food, sleep, and sex. This fourth drive, says psychopharmacologist Ronald K. Siegel, is a natural part of our biology, creating an irresistible demand for intoxicating substances. We're going to talk with Dr. Siegel and draw upon his 20 years of groundbreaking research to provide countless examples of the intoxication urge in humans, animals, and even insects. My guest today, Professor Ronald K. Siegel, is a psychopharmacologist on the faculty of the Department of Psychiatric and Biobehavioral Sciences at the UCLA School of Medicine, and is a leading authority on the social and psychological effects of drug use. He's the author of Fire in the Brain and Whispers, The Voice of Paranoia. Stay with me for the next hour as we dive into the inner psyche of our need for intoxication. I'd like to welcome Professor Ronald K. Siegel, author of Intoxication, The Universal Drive for Mind-Altering Substances. Thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Anne. I'm pleased to be with you.
Now, can I call you Ron?
Yes.
All right. Can you tell me what drove you to write this book initially?
Well, I have been studying drugs and animals for most of my career, and started out by watching animals. And we discovered, myself and my research teams, all over the world, in Asia and Africa, in Australia, in Canada, all over in South America, we found that animals eat plant drugs. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to know why they do that.
Mm-hmm.
Because it doesn't seem to have any nutritional benefit for them. And we discovered that they seem to do it for the same reasons we do. And there seems to be, in every part of the planet, there seems to be this universal drive to pursue intoxication. Animals seem to have this drive, including us, to alter the way in which we feel.
Mm-hmm.
And it's convenient for animals in the wild to find these sources in the plants. In fact, most of our drugs were discovered by our ancestors watching animals to see what they would eat and how it affected them. The legendary discovery of coffee was in 900 AD by an Abyssinian shepherd who noticed that his goats became abnormally frisky after eating these little berries from the coffee plant. And the shepherd tried that and discovered that he became, well, abnormally frisky. And almost every drug has a story, has a legend, has folklore, and direct observations of its discovery by watching animals when they're sick and wounded,
mm-hmm.
Leading us to antibiotic sources, leading us to stimulants, leading us to depressants.
Mm-hmm.
And we discovered that this was a natural behavior in the animal kingdom. And, of course, history records that in every part of the planet, we also, throughout history, in every age, we have done the same thing as a species. We have pursued intoxication
mm-hmm.
with plant drugs and other mind-altering substances. And when you think about it, it makes sense because our brain is a three-pound sack of chemicals. Of course, we're more than that.
Mm-hmm.
We're much more than that. But we are that, too. And our brain manufactures a natural hallucinogen called DMT, which is stronger than LSD. Our brain manufactures a pain reducer called endorphins, which are as strong as morphine or opium. Our body and our nervous system manufacture adrenaline, which is a stimulant that works very much like amphetamines and cocaine. So it's natural that we're going to have an affinity for other substances in our environment, which literally turn us on, which meld very nicely with our own chemistry.
Now, Ron, for us, it seems that we would take an intoxication or indulge in that to be able to either find the meaning of life or to escape from our own consciousness. But an animal, why do you think an animal would want to do that?
Well, they do it for the same reasons we do it. They do it to change the way in which they feel.
Mm.
During the Vietnam conflict, our observers watched water buffalo going out of their, within combat zones, going out of their way to break into opium poppy fields and nibble the opium. And we were able to observe them under the influence of opium when they started to stagger and sway and fall down. And then after the Vietnam War, we saw many of these same water buffalo go through the bovine equivalent of withdrawal.
Mm.
Now, it's the same thing that our soldiers did.
Mm-hmm.
They turned to opium and heroin to relieve, and other drugs to relieve the stress of combat. Elephants and other migratory animals in South Africa and in Asia go out of their way to eat the fermented fruit of certain trees, which turns into about an 8% drink for them.
Mm-hmm.
And we notice that when the animals are stressed, and we produce this experimentally in game parks by just decreasing the amount of space that they have to move around in, or introducing other species that they don't get along too well with, like rhino.
Mm-hmm.
And they seem to be under stress, and we could tell they're under stress because they start flapping their ears and they do all kinds of elephant-like things that, to indicate that,
mm-hmm.
And they trumpet in a certain way. They drank more. They ate more of this fermented.
Oh, really?
So they're doing it to change the way in which they feel. Now, interestingly, the animals don't have problems with this. We have all the problems. Why? Because we have not learned the lessons from all of these animals. And this is one of the reasons I was writing the book. It's because the animals have a lot to teach us. They've been doing this for millennia.
Mm-hmm.
And they do not have the problems because they are using natural compounds that have small amounts of intoxicants in them. For example, the llamas in South America eat the coca leaf.
Mm-hmm.
It contains about 1% cocaine, enough to make them a little stronger in the mountains. The Indians do the same thing. They
mm-hmm.
chew it too.
Right.
And they become stronger and more and can endure the altitude and all the physical labor that they go through with more ease. And when you ask these Indians, and I lived with them for a while, do you know anything about cocaine? Of course they know about cocaine because some of them traffic in it.
Mm-hmm.
But do they do it? No, that's a disgusting habit. They just chew the leaves. And what we have done, being the clever primates that we think we are, we have ripped apart that leaf,
mm-hmm.
pulled out the cocaine, concentrated it down, devised methods for injecting it directly into our blood or smoking it directly into our lungs.
Mm-hmm.
And then we ask why we have a problem. We have a problem because we're screwing around with Mother Nature. We're taking relatively safe, benign medicines and turning them into poisons. And I submit to you that all the problems we have with drugs and medicines on this planet are due to patterns of use and dosages gone haywire.
Yes, and so we've kind of gotten greedy. We've taken something that may have 1% cocaine into it, and we've, like you say, extracted it and into megadoses.
It's the same thing with coffee. You know, if people were snorting caffeine and smoking caffeine instead of drinking a very dilute beverage, we would have a lot more dependency and a lot more toxicity in the world today than we do with just the drinking of the beverage, which in the form of cola beverages or coffee beverages can be tolerated and can be useful, and it is a useful medicine. So the difference between a drug becoming a medicine and a drug becoming a poison is really the dosage and the way in which you use it.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. So it moves from a safe drug into a life-threatening drug.
And the way to solve the you're exactly right. And the way to solve the problem is to make it perfectly safe. Nobody wants people dying of alcoholism or mm-hmm. getting run over by drunk drivers. No one wants people living out their lives inside crack houses and doing nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Or dying of overdoses, or having workplace problems, or having driving under the influence problems.
Liver problems.
we know enough that people cannot control these drugs, and that we have to provide safe, controllable forms. But in order to do that, we have to acknowledge that intoxication serves a medical need. We are medicating ourselves. We are changing the way in which we feel. I don't care if you do it with coffee or Prozac or a sleeping pill that the doctor prescribes for you or something you bought from your dealer on the street.
Mm-hmm.
People use the drugs to change the way in which they feel, the same reason that animals do it. And there's nothing wrong with that if it can be safe and maybe even healthy.
So how do you feel about the society, the pressure we're getting today from, say, the government say no to drugs? I mean, obviously the street drugs and the greed and all of that that's going on behind it is forcing that because of the deaths and the youth that are getting involved and they're dropping out of society. And but how do you...
We can't say no, Anne. We can't. Getting high is an unstoppable natural drive.
Hmm.
We can't say no. It doesn't work. The brain says yes. And also, this war against drugs, which was officially launched in 1971 by President Nixon, is something that is a misnomer because we're not talking about prescription medication, which... More people die every year from prescription drug abuse than from all of the illegal drugs put together.
Mm-hmm.
More people die from alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
I think in the United States today, including Hawaii, I think it's something like 500 deaths a day.
Whoa.
And for tobacco and related disorder, it's 1,000 deaths a day.
Really?
And how many from cocaine? Maybe a handful, and most of those are gunshot wounds.
From dealers.
but probably more from aspirin every day, from allergic reactions, than from cocaine. So none of these drugs are perfectly safe. There's always a risk to taking them. But we can minimize that. We can engineer these things. We're doing experiments now with different forms of these compounds. For example, working with a cocaine chewing gum. Use it as an antidepressant. We don't really have a safe antidepressant to use in psychiatry today. They're all kind of very, they have a lot of side effects and very, very risky to use. And but cocaine seems to have some benefits when used in a different form, when used in the coca form. And we're exploring the possibility of using a chewing gum. And we did some studies on this. It is a very safe vehicle for controlling exactly how much is put into the gum and how much can come out and how fast it can come out. Sort of like a time-release capsule.
Mm-hmm. Is this going to be available to the public?
No, probably not. But it's a model for the way in which we can engineer these things.
Yes.
And we know a lot about molecular architecture now, and we can sculpt these compounds, and we can mold and shape them to have very specific effects. But even if we had such a safe intoxicant, I think we have to have a place in our society where people can use it.
Mm-hmm.
We know that our experience with alcohol has been disastrous. We do have rules about where you can use it. You can't use it behind the wheel. You can't use it on the street. You have to go to a bar or a restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be a certain age.
Mm-hmm.
And even with all of those rules and constraints, we have a lot of problems because the drug itself is not that safe. There are alternatives that are being investigated, and I write about them in the book. Think about this. A drug like alcohol that you drink, and in a half hour you're sober. No matter how much you drink.
Well,
you're sober in a half hour after you complete your last drink. There are lots of things that can be done.
Uh-huh.
There are and dream with me for a moment, Anne, what would be wrong if we had a drug or drugs that were perfectly safe, that never caused addiction or death, never caused workplace problems, occupational dysfunction, driving under the influence problems, that were as safe and maybe as healthy to use as the foods and waters that we try to use.
Wow, that would be amazing.
What would be wrong is purely from a religious or spiritual or cultural point of view that getting high or changing the way in which you feel that way is not convenient.
How does say the religious ideas of abstinence work with what you're saying? Because if you're saying we can't say no, or we maybe shouldn't be saying no, when people do abstain, is that unnatural to force themselves not to?
No, but I think what would be unnatural is to expect them never to have some alterations in mood.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they may be able to do this other ways.
Mm-hmm.
They may be able to meditate. They may be able to dance and sing. Mm-hmm. And alter their consciousness in that way.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing that is true of our species, that throughout history people have been dancing and singing and going through all kinds of physical and psychological techniques to alter their consciousness, but they also, throughout history, have always been using intoxicants.
Mm-hmm.
A good example is the current use of methamphetamine.
Mm-hmm.
And that scares a lot of people because it's so associated with violent crime in America today.
Right, because of the addiction.
But it is a prescription drug. We use it, we give it to young children for attentional deficit disorders. We use it in the military. Our pilots in the Middle East right now, today, as we speak, are using it on long bombing runs.
Wow.
In fact, most of the friendly fire accidents that occurred during the Afghan war were due to pilots under the influence of too much methamphetamine or amphetamine. The military call it go pills.
Uh-huh.
And they've been using it since World War II.
Uh-huh.
World War II was a war that was fought with both sides, all three sides, under the influence of amphetamines. The kamikaze pilots in Japan used it. American forces and the British forces used it in both their ground campaigns as well as the Royal Air Force used it for their pilots, and the Nazis used it. In fact, Hitler was the world's first methamphetamine addict. It was made especially for him. He used to get these little pills wrapped in gold foil. He developed a lot of mental disorders as a function of that, including a lot of paranoia. And when you think about Adolf Hitler, you may have an image of him ranting and raving and bellowing and throwing his fist in the air.
Mm-hmm.
And that guy was high. He was speeding on meth and amphetamine. And at the very end in the bunker, they ran out of amphetamines. And all they had left were cocaine eye drops for him. And he was given the cocaine eye drops, and his pupils were so dilated that he was virtually blind at the end when he committed suicide.
Wow. What is meth derived from?
A methamphetamine is derived from a plant called ephedra. And ephedra...
Oh.
Ephedra grows wild in various parts of Asia. And it is believed by some... archaeologists and anthropologists believe ephedra is the real soma, is the divine intoxicant of the Vedic hymns. It was not the mushrooms,
really?
The Amanita mushrooms, but it was the ephedra. And I think that's academically pretty well established, although it's not known by the public. They still believe the red cap mushrooms, and that's how that's used in the making of the methamphetamine. It is a prescription drug. It's a very useful medicine. The dosages that we give in psychiatry as an antidepressant, the dosages that are used for weight control and obesity management programs,
mm-hmm.
are very low compared to what the street users, and that's the problem.
Ephedra is a stimulant, right?
Badger is a stimulant. Some listeners may recognize the name Mao Wang,
yeah,
which is a Chinese term,
right,
that refers to the same plant. It's now illegal,
right,
in the United States, but it's still available on the internet. There's still a big stockpile of a lot of herbal supplements containing it,
uh-huh,
that are not marked appropriately, or that use obscure Chinese words for it that you only find in one little village someplace in northern China. We've seen it all, but mm-hmm, it is the molecule of ephedra is a stimulant, and this is the plant from which methamphetamine is derived. As a matter of fact, it was discovered at UCLA here.
Really?
Yeah, and it was one of my colleagues was the guy who first discovered it, sold the patent to a pharmaceutical company.
Amazing. And now here it is as a street drug and quite a problem.
Yes, it is, all over the world. Since 1985, it has been more associated with violent crime than even cocaine.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of... there's only one drug that has more association with violent crime in America, and that's alcohol.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Datura plant, which grows all over Hawaii, you know, we've got it everywhere.
Yeah, it's a beautiful plant.
The belladonna. A beautiful plant and smells incredible. I've also heard it known, called the zombie plant. You've written quite a bit about it, and maybe you can tell us about how it's been used throughout time and especially some of the initiations that the young boys have had to undergo with it.
Yeah, well, it's a plant that is ubiquitous all over the planet, and it has a lot of associations with it, with rituals that involved the stupefying effects of it.
Mm-hmm.
It was used as one of the plants in the Aztec sacrifices. It is used because it's a deliriant and a stupefying agent. It's just used to alter consciousness. It's also a livestock poison. A lot of grazing animals,
mm-hmm,
have munched on this accidentally. There are some plants out there that animals know to stay away from, but every so often they'll browse a plant or munch on something strange and suffer the consequences, and Datura can be particularly deadly.
Mm-hmm.
Just like tobacco, if you watch the animals, as we have watched in South Africa, we've watched baboons going after wild tobacco, they stay away from the seeds because the seeds are... We've seen ostriches drop dead in 10 minutes after eating the seeds. They stay away from the mature leaves. The baboons are smart. They go up to the top of the plant and they pick up the fresh, young little leaves that have the least amount of nicotine, but has almost nothing else for them. But they seem to like this. And there are a few that we have watched and tagged that have become quote unquote addicted to it. I don't like that word because it sounds very pejorative.
Mm-hmm.
But they have become dependent on it.
Mm-hmm.
They go back to it. And they revisit the plants, and again they're very careful, just to pick the top leaves. And baboons, like people, learn by watching their elders, and the young baboons copy that, and so the habit spreads throughout the entire group.
Where do you think addiction, the word, you know, where's the line where it becomes an addiction in comparison to, you know, most people drink milk every day. Would you say they're addicted to milk?
Well, addiction comes from the Latin meaning, addicare, meaning to have a passion for something. And to that extent, you can have a passion for milk. You can have a passion for sex. You can have a passion for religion and for,
mm-hmm,
all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
But when we talk about addiction in the pharmacological sense, we're talking about the presence of two things, tolerance It means that you need more and more of the drug to get to the same place.
Uh-huh.
You become tolerant to it.
Uh-huh.
And the second signpost of addiction is that when you remove the drug, you precipitate a whole cluster of symptoms that are in the opposite direction of the intoxication.
Uh-huh.
If methamphetamine makes you stimulated, the withdrawal is you sleep a lot.
Uh-huh.
If it makes you less hungry when you're high in the withdrawal, you're going to eat a lot.
Right.
So the withdrawal is always in the opposite direction. And heroin makes you feel real good, and it makes you pain-free. And in the withdrawal, you feel rotten and nauseated, and you're shaking, and you're full of pain.
You wrote about a very interesting observation with opium and when the masters, and particularly monkeys and dogs, whose masters would smoke the opium, and then when the masters didn't smoke or weren't around for a day or 2 days, the animals would go through the depression.
It appeared to be, no one ever interviewed these animals to be absolutely sure how they felt, but they certainly acted as if they were depressed. I mean, I think that anyone who's a pet owner who's got a relationship with a dog or a cat can usually tell
mm-hmm.
when their animal is a little depressed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what these people were saying, is that these pets and these animals that frequented the opium dens became depressed. They were probably sleeping a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And then they were probably, when they were under the influence of the opium smoke and when it wasn't around, they probably were not feeling good. They probably were physically ill,
uh-huh.
just like we are. And when my dog is physically ill, it looks depressed.
Yeah.
Just curls up on the couch in a little ball and doesn't eat and doesn't play with the doggy toys. And I would like to say he's depressed.
Right. And one particular dog, when his master went through a detoxification, actually died. In the 60s, you had reported that. I thought that was interesting.
Yes. There are lots of stories like that.
Yeah.
The thing that impressed me about collecting all of this information over 35 years I've been
yes.
doing this,
yes.
Is that the same stories are told again and again. These animals are just like us.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that is really exciting because it shows that there's a harmony to this inner landscape that we visit when we get intoxicated that makes us more like all the other life forms on this planet.
It's where we'd rather be, isn't it? I mean, we would rather be in that lovely, floaty, relaxed, no problem, stress-free place.
Well, not all the time. I mean, sometimes,
right.
when you're an animal struggling for survival on the savannah, you don't want to be blissed out when a predator jumps on your jugular.
Right.
You want to be able to run.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to have an environment in which it's safe. It's interesting that most of the animals in the wild use stimulant drugs because that helps their survival, as opposed to drugs which knock them out. This isn't beneficial in a Darwinian sense.
Mm-hmm.
For them to survive if they're going to be sedated all the time. So we need to have the right environment. And having restaurants and clubs and indoor cafes and things like that is a start. But I think we have to have an environment, a place in our thinking where getting intoxicated is okay. Just like it's okay to go to a movie and get intoxicated on the movie. It's okay to be there and be totally immersed in another reality on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
And someday it'll be what Huxley described as feelies, where there'll be more than just three-dimensional. You'll be feeling through electrodes in the arms of the chairs or something like that. You'll be feeling the emotions of the actors. There has to be a safe place to do that. You don't do that while you're... You don't do that any more than you should be talking on your cell phone when you're driving. You're not going to be watching TV or watching a movie while you're driving.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay
mm-hmm.
for the people in the back seat, but not for the driver.
Mm-hmm.
There has to be a place. And there has to be a place in our society mm-hmm. in our thinking for doing this kind of experience. And I think we will eventually evolve to that. I think it's happening in a sense. Science fiction writers have enjoyed a lot of speculation about this. And one of my favorites was a movie called Logan's Run, which is based on the book of the same name,
mm-hmm.
which described a world in the future in which there was an arcade, and you walked into the, as we have many shopping malls with arcades in them,
mm-hmm.
where you can go and play video games and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Only this one, when you walk through, there was some kind of intoxicating vapor in the air.
Mm.
And as you walk through the room, you got high, and you saw all kinds of colorful things. It was like walking through a rave party. And then when you got to the other end, the exit door, you were sober again. Well, that room has been made. They just opened an exhibit at the Museum of Contemporary Art here in Los Angeles. The exhibit is entitled Ecstasy. And they have lots of interactive performance art types of exhibits. And one is a room like this that you walk through, and it simulates the intoxication of a rave party.
Does it actually use a drug?
No. It doesn't use a drug that I know of, although outside the room there is a big fountain of LSD. And it really is a fountain full of LSD. You can't go near it. It's guarded and everything else. This is an amazing exhibit, and if anyone has an opportunity to see it, I would recommend, I don't know where it's going to be after Los Angeles. It's going to be here in Los Angeles at the Museum of Contemporary Art until February. And it simulates many aspects of these altered states through non-drug techniques.
Wow, that's
and I think that will be another answer. But again, you have to be able to have a controlled place.
Uh-huh.
And until we do that, that doesn't mean that we should legalize ecstasy, that we should legalize LSD, that we should legalize marijuana or any of these other intoxicants. And I wish to God we could take back what we said about alcohol and tobacco being safe at some point.
Mm-hmm.
These drugs are not perfectly safe and not perfectly healthy, and we have to do something to control the abuse of them now while the research and development for alternative things continues. And that will happen, I say, probably these compounds are emerging now. Some of them are available, I suspect that it will be in our lifetime that we'll be able to see the use of that. I mean, drug companies are spending billions of dollars a year trying to find better antidepressants, better stimulants,
mm-hmm.
better sleeping pills, mm-hmm. better drugs for cancer, all kinds of things. And eventually they're going to hit ones that have some kind of intoxicating appeal.
Mm-hmm. In Hawaii, as you probably know, marijuana is legal for medical use. And it has been considered a safe recreational drug. What's your opinion on that?
I don't think it's the perfectly safe one that I'm talking about. I think it may be a lot safer than from a medical point of view, from a physiological point of view, from a cancer point of view, it may be a lot safer than tobacco. Certainly from a toxicity point of view, we don't know of any lethal dose of it,
mm-hmm.
but we don't know of a lethal dose of LSD for people either.
Mm-hmm.
LSD, is physiologically probably a lot safer than marijuana, simply because it comes out of the body much faster. It doesn't have a lot of the secondary problems in the lungs. It doesn't have some of the motivational problems. It doesn't have some of the driving under the influence problems that marijuana has.
Mm-hmm.
So this is, I know I'm stepping on some economic toes there in Hawaii because it's a big industry.
Mm-hmm.
And I've spent a lot of time in Hawaii And some of my best friends have been marijuana growers that have allowed me onto their property to study animals that are eating their plants and to film them and things like that. So I've spent a lot of time there, and certainly the toxicity of those plants that I have studied in Hawaiian gardens is a lot less than the toxicity of plants that I've studied on, let's say, the Parker Ranch on the Big Island, where there's a lot of livestock poisons that go on from animals eating poisonous range plants. And also on the Hana Ranch, where I've studied some animals.
Is that the what's that plant that you had written about that was very toxic in Hawaii? The bracken.
Yeah, bracken fern. There are a lot of toxic plants that are accidentally nibbled and poisoning, range animals. This certainly is far more dangerous and poisonous than the marijuana plants. But what I like about the medical marijuana movement is the use of the word medical. Because that's what all these drugs are. They're medicines. We use them to change the way in which we feel. Now, if it's okay, and it seems like it's a very simple step to take, if it's okay to use marijuana to medically reduce your nausea in chemotherapy, to medically lower your eye pressure in the treatment of glaucoma, if it's medically okay to do that, the next step is say it's medically okay to alter your consciousness, which is a much wider medical need than the need to treat nausea or to treat glaucoma. Marijuana has a much broader medical need, medical purpose in satisfying the natural drive, this fourth drive, which is as strong as the drive of hunger, thirst, and sex. It's unstoppable. And that's the drive to intoxicate. And marijuana satisfies that drive better than it satisfies the needs for nausea control or glaucoma control.
You know, I find that there's a lot of hypocrites in our society that will tell us that altering our consciousness is not what we should be looking at, and yet they will be drinking alcohol. And like they not to alter our consciousness with drugs. That's but alcohol, tobacco, and coffee, sugar, they're all used on a daily basis, and it seems to be quite fine.
That's right. They don't consider alcohol and tobacco and prescription medication and over-the-counter drugs to be drugs. These are medicines.
Right.
And that's what I'm saying. We have to alter the thinking here and the language to talk about altering consciousness is a medical need. Serves a medical purpose. And we want to do it safely. And the drugs that they're using out there, like alcohol and tobacco, are not safe. Marijuana may be safer, but it's not that safe either. And I want to get a big argument here about the technical aspects of marijuana, but if you talk to anybody who's been doing research with it, you'll find that it's a messy drug. It's got a lot of, it's just not clean. A clean drug would be like nitrous oxide. It goes in and out of the body. As soon as you stop inhaling it, this laughing gas we're talking about, as soon as you stop inhaling it and breathing room air, you come down, and there's no change in the chemistry in the body. Simple as that.
And
that's a clean drug. And a drug that comes out of the body quickly.
And marijuana doesn't.
No, marijuana. We routinely pick up traces of marijuana in the body 6 weeks after last use. It stays around for a long period of time. It's a very interesting compound because there's so many different components to the plant. We're not talking about a single molecule. We're talking about hundreds of components in the plant.
And what's the problem with it being in the body longer than a cleaner drug?
Well, it depends on the amount. There is some strong evidence of things like changes that people interpret as I'm more relaxed, I'm less excitable. That can translate into sedation. That can translate into what has been termed the amotivational syndrome. And that's okay too if you're just leading an agrarian life or you're doing day labor. But if you're driving at an 18-wheeler at high speed on a freeway,
I don't want to be sedated.
This kind of mental state may not be functional.
Yes.
May be dangerous, and that's why I say we have to have a place where this can be used, where this can be used and not abused. It protects everybody.
Do you also work and research any of the ways to pull these things out of the body, to detox the body?
We know how to do it, but we don't. I'm not currently doing research on that. Actually, I'm looking at new drugs that the animals have led me to. We're tearing apart. We have one now that we're very excited about, which has been sitting in our vault for a long, long time, and we just started looking at it. It's a plant that was used by Native American Indians.
Which one is that? Peyote?
I'm not going to identify it.
Okay.
It's a plant that has not been studied in terms of its psychoactive effects. But we only knew that the Native Americans used in the Rocky Mountain area used it as a narcotic. But it's not a narcotic.
Mm-hmm.
It appears to be an hallucinogen. But it is a very short-acting one. It has no side effects that we can think of that we can find. And we're trying to tear it apart now chemically to find out what it is. We still have not identified the business end of it, the actual specific molecules and what they're doing. It seems to be very unique, a very unique plant. We have a lot of plants like that that we haven't had a chance to tear apart that we've picked up in the field, and particularly in the Amazon area, where, interestingly, most of the drugs on this planet grow in the Amazon.
Yes. How about ayahuasca? Have you ever done any research with that?
Yes, we have. Uh-huh. Yes, we have.
Do you actually try it yourself?
I am fortunate in that I have a lot of subjects who will do it for me. So
right.
I don't have that problem. We have a laboratory here at UCLA where over the years we have been licensed to give many of these compounds to volunteers in the laboratory and study them.
Mm-hmm.
So I can take a much more objective perspective on it, although I do write about some of my experiences in the book in which I played animal. I mean, in order to find out what these animals were doing, I ate what they ate.
Yes.
And I nibbled on the same plants, sometimes with very comical effects, sometimes with very unpleasant effects.
That was very brave of you.
Well, I only nibbled.
Yeah.
But some of these plants were so powerful that the nibble was too much.
Really? Oh, the story that you open your book with was really, really grabs you. The character that you call Daniel and his drinking of the tea. And the results of his drinking of the tea. The tea, I believe, was from...
It was a Datura.
Yes, the Datura.
It was a Datura tea, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, that's enough to keep you wanting to read the book.
Well, I hope people will do that. I mean, and I hope that they'll read some of my other books, too, that are reflections on... or that are extensions of some of these things.
Well, what are your other books, Ron?
Well, I did a book called Fire in the Brain, in which I talked about how ordinary people in extraordinary situations can have hallucinations and what hallucinations are like. Now, some of them were drug stories. Some of them were non-drug stories, people caught in hostage situations, victims of kidnapping, children with imaginary companions, sort of exploring how the brain hallucinates. And some of these people I worked with in the laboratory, other people I lived with for a while to really fully understand their experiences. And then I did another book entitled Whispers, the subtitle, The Voices of Paranoia, in which I tell the stories of some of the best paranoids that I ever met, and trying to illustrate what it's like to live in the paranoid world. And to do that, I had to actually enter it myself. For example, working with one Vietnam veteran who had been held in a tiger cage as a POW in North Vietnam, and he went through all kinds of experiences. We built a tiger cage here, and I let him, which was a mistake, lock me in the cage.
Oh, gosh.
And then he disappeared for several days.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and so I write about those experiences of which I went through, the terror and the paranoia of you know, being naked in a tiger cage for a while. I lived with some very interesting paranoids, and there's one in the book that I think people might enjoy, which it's called Interview with Hitler's Brain. When I first came to UCLA, there was a story that they had Hitler's brain in a bottle in the basement someplace in the medical school. Hitler's brain, by the way, has never been found. The body was found. It was autopsied by the Russians after the war. But the brain was missing.
Really?
Yeah. So there were all kinds of stories about what happened to it. And when I heard that, they had it in UCLA. And I met the guy who claimed to be the custodian of it. And a German with a very thick accent, very, very large man, was a graduate student. And he had he allowed me to interview the brain.
How did you do that?
Well, I did it through a teletype machine. And computer terminal.
Wow.
And I give the full transcript of that interview in the book and what happened.
But go into that a little bit more.
Now, this guy was paranoid, but so was Hitler. And I became one, too.
But when you say you interviewed him, how did you get responses? I mean, what did you do? Did you hook something up to the bottle that it was in?
Well, I wasn't told what was on the other end. I was never shown the brain. I was just told that here's Adolf, and you know, go for it.
So you asked questions?
I asked questions, yeah.
And then you would get what, an electrical response?
No, I got the printouts. I mean, it's like email. I got answers. And this was before email. I mean, this was. You got to remember, the internet was developed here at UCLA.
It was?
Yes, and the first transmissions went from UCLA to Stanford via teletype, and these were those teletype terminals that we used for the interview with Hitler.
That's fascinating. Gosh, you've done some interesting stuff. Good. Now, so I just want to let our audience know, I'm talking with Professor Ronald K. Siegel from UCLA, and we're talking about his latest book, which is Intoxication, The Universal Drive for Mind-Altering Substances. Ron, I'm presuming this is your latest book.
Well, it's a new edition of an older book, but it is the latest one, yes.
Okay, so I would love to get some of your other books and do interviews with you on those, too. That sounds really fascinating.
Okay.
Yeah. So how long ago do you think was the first hallucinogen on the planet, and what do you think it was?
Oh, that's a good question. I think in terms of archaeological evidence, one of the oldest plants that we know of is marijuana, which was used at least 10,000 years ago, maybe earlier. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there was a lot of drug use by Neanderthals. We have evidence for ephedra being used.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know what their experiences were, but we have some archaeological evidence that they used ephedra. Now, keep in mind that's a stimulant, but it can produce any stimulant, if you take enough of it, can become an hallucinogen. Because that's how they work in the brain. So this could have been one of the first altered states. It could have been alcohol, accidental use of fermented fruit or grain. I mean, the ease with which stored grain or stored rice or stored fruit ferments and turns into alcohol suggests that that may have been one of the earliest intoxicants that people used.
Do you think they stumbled across alcohol by accident?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely by accident. Although the Bible says differently. The Bible says, of course, the Bible is a lot newer than Neanderthals. The Bible says that Noah was the world's first drunkard.
Oh, really?
And that he discovered... He discovered the effects by watching goats nibbling on the fermented grapes.
Uh-huh.
And in some of the older German Bibles that I have examined, there are actually illustrations in these illuminated manuscripts of goats nibbling the grapes, and Noah pointing to the Noah drunk and pointing to the goats doing that. And allegedly he came back and told his three sons what happened. And they all became, cultivators of the grape. This was the start, supposedly, of alcohol use, but it obviously has to have been just a folklore story. I mean, not the goats may not have done this accidentally, but it had to have been earlier in time than Noah.
So it seems like throughout time, birds, insects, even, and animals have had a tendency to enjoy the alcohol.
Absolutely.
Enjoy
is an interesting word. I mean, I would like to say that. I would like to emphasize about some of that, because I've spent so much time with these animals that I feel that I can speak for them in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
They seem to get very playful, some of these animals. And you can see this as you move up the phylogenetic scale to primates.
Uh-huh.
You watch primates working with fermented fruit. You can see that. It's hard to tell when an insect is really high. It's hard to tell. I mean, I've watched a lot of drunk warthogs stumbling around, and it's really hard to say whether they're enjoying themselves or not.
Or if they have a hangover.
But when you get an animal that can vocalize, like a baboon or a chimpanzee, and you can understand some of the vocalizations, that some of them are pleasure calls.
Uh-huh.
And when you can understand elephants, and some of the calls that elephants use have been interpreted as pleasure calls and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Then you can start anthropomorphizing a little better. And I'm a little more comfortable about talking about the higher animals perhaps enjoying themselves, and especially when they do it again and again. And that's where we get into tagging them and marking them and putting collars around them and things like that. We can't tag and mark and put collars around ants very easily. But, ants will get intoxicated. I describe that in the book. I describe how they, seem to be disoriented and roll around, stuff like that. But whether that's accidental or not, I don't know. When people get sick, they roll around and get disoriented too. I mean, think of the last time you had a fever delirium. And you got out of bed to go to the bathroom, and you wobbled around.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't so much fun.
Right.
Yeah. So it's hard to tell with lower animals.
So we're getting close to the end of the interview time. It's gone so fast. Do you think it's possible to use drugs regularly and to do it in a conscious and controlled way, like our food or our diet or exercise?
Sure, because we do that already with a lot of our drugs, our medicines like aspirin. A lot of people take baby aspirin every day
for their hearts
as a preventative way of dealing with cardiac problems.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people take vitamins every day. These are drugs.
Mm-hmm.
In a controlled way. But when you start talking about drugs which alter our perception,
mm-hmm.
our thinking, our mood, our memory, then you have to have special time and place to do that.
Right.
And people are doing that now at the marijuana parties, at the cocaine parties, at the beer parties.
Yes.
At the tobacco parties. At the cocktail parties, at the rave parties, where they're using everything now,
mm-hmm.
Ecstasy and methamphetamine and ketamine and all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
So people are having these environments already constructed. The problems come when they leave that environment and they're still under the influence, mm-hmm. and they enter into another environment which cannot tolerate it.
Right.
And so we have to have places for this. We have to have the right compounds for this. And until we face that, we're going to continue to have a war on drugs until we recognize that the war on drugs is a war against ourselves. It's a war against our very nature.
Mm.
And instead of denying it, we have to sort of accept what we are and learn to do it better and in a healthy, safe way.
When you look at India or countries like Turkey or Cambodia, they actually do have places, don't they, that people can, I mean, they have their opium dens and where people can go in and they stay there, they do their journey, their trip. And
the problem, of course, with opium is that a lot of these people never leave the dens.
Yeah.
This
so addictive.
This can be modified. This can be improved. We have people that are on opiates every day on an outpatient basis and for pain management.
Uh-huh.
They can control it because the pills are time-release pills. The prescriptions directions control the delivery of it a little bit.
Does it give them the same high?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but they can get tolerant to that.
Mm-hmm.
They can get tolerant to that.
Mm-hmm. So they're actually being prescribed here in the United States?
Yes. Yes, opiates are very, very common in pain management. We have drugs that are stronger than opium.
Mm.
That are being prescribed. I mean, there's a lot of abuse of that.
Yes.
And
what are those drugs?
What are they?
Yes.
Vicodin is one.
Oh yeah.
Percocet, Percodan, Dilaudid, Oxycodone.
Uh-huh. And they're very toxic for the liver. Those that you mentioned, the Vicodin. And
so is yeah. A lot. Most drugs are. It's at certain doses because that's mm-hmm. what. That's where they end up in the liver.
Right, right.
And the enzymes that are produced in the liver help metabolize it, and it's a lot big strain on it.
Mm-hmm.
Alcohol produces the biggest problem
right,
in the liver.
Right. Absolutely. Any words of wisdom for our listeners?
Buy my book, read it, or don't even buy it. Take it out of the library if you want. But I would encourage you to read it and to think about the fact that intoxication serves a medical need and that we have to stop talking about drugs. We have to start talking about medicines.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Ron. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Well, thank you, Anne. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you.